Boys and girls, we were just talking about tides and tide ice and the rivers and everything else. And by the way, this is Fish and Frank, and Robert's in the chair across from me. And RJ, as usual, is trying to keep us under control. And good luck, buddy. All right. We were talking about, I went on fishandfranks.com, hit the weather and tides button, go down the page, click the Peace River. It gives you a real good idea of what the rains have been like. And a day ago, the river dropped to 5.5 feet, and overnight went up to 7.5, and it's still going up. Big influx of fresh water with all the rain we've had. Now, I'm not sure where that puts us according to the average. Let's see. The mean is 339 cubic feet a second, and right now we've beat the maximum ever, which was 1982. There was 2,250 cubic feet a second coming down the river, and right now there's 2,820, so we've blown a new record for this year at this time in May, and like I say, the average is 339, so we're 4 or 5 times over the normal amount of water flow coming down the Peace River at this point. That's right. Going to change a lot of stuff, including the tarpon and the bait and all that, and that's kind of why we're going over that. And everything affects everything. When RJ twists a knob, everything in the room gets affected. You know that. We never know. We don't want to go there. Okay. Right. Anyway, forgetting about knob twisting and slider things going and all that. Robert, hello.
Hello.
All right. What's that, all that water coming down the river going to do?
Well, like you said, it's going to definitely move the bait around a lot. And because it's been fairly consistent for the last several weeks, we're going to see some pretty big changes. People have been catching bait in the upper end of the harbor, but with that much water flow, it's going to start moving it down south. There'll be a lot of guys whining, going, I've got to drive my boat all the way down to the bottom part of the harbor to go catch fish. And my usual answer is, it's better than swimming.
Yeah.
I mean, we're fortunate to have a boat and go out there and fish with. And it's like, I'm sorry, you got to burn an extra 2 or 3 gallons of gas to go catch fish. But, you know, we're pretty lucky.
Well,
people don't realize that.
In the wintertime, our seasons are just every bit as drastic as if you live in Wisconsin or New York. The only difference is up there, you see the water, and it's very hard, and it thunks. It's ice.
Yeah.
And then in the summertime, it's wet. But down here, we get the summertime, you got one thing, and in the wintertime, you have another. Now, all winter long, you don't have to leave the upper end of the harbor.
No.
Plenty of fish, more fish than actually what's down there.
Sometimes you don't even need to leave your canal.
No, it's awesome. But the closer we get to July, August, the less fish in the canals, the less fish in the upper harbor, the more you got to go down to the intercoastal, find that saltier, cooler water, because hot water doesn't hold oxygen. These are saltwater fish. They prefer to live in salt water. They can handle the brackish water, the fresh water, for quite a while. It doesn't really bother them. But, you know,
a lot of times their food can't, though. And that's a huge part of it, you know. That, you know, it's like snook, tarpon, redfish. They can all live in 100% fresh water if they need to. But if there's no food around, which most of the food source in the harbor has to have that higher salinity, so you can't breathe and you can't eat. There's no real reason to stick around.
No, I'd say it's a pretty good reason to move, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like, you know, never mind. I was going to do a political joke, but I won't.
No, no political
jokes. All right. No, I'm not going to. All right. Dr. Dash? I don't know what that was. Your phone's ringing.
For my appointment later.
Oh, okay. Anyway, well, this isn't one of the ones we do recorded, so you're kind of stuck right here, buddy.
Yep.
If you want to go out in the hall and deal with it, go ahead.
Nope.
I got
I'm good.
This. All right. I mean, RJ's here to back me up.
He's going to back us all up.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think
that's
it's
his
up
job. He's the cooler over there.
All
right. Little do they know.
He needs his little sawed-off shotgun to sit over there in the corner and watch everything.
I could see him in a chair on the balcony, like in a Western.
Yeah.
I could see him with that, with the sawed-off shotgun, you know?
Yep.
All right. Anyway, we're going to get into the top five. I'd love to tell you the fishing story, but honestly, I've been building studios, and we had somebody leave at the bait shop. We did all of our ordering, trying to get orders done. It's just been kind of chaotic. I do want to go on snook. What's going on with the snook? I mean, you've got it part of the top five this week.
Yeah, and I'm usually not a big promoter of snook when the season's closed, but, you know, the catch-and-release snook fishing right now is absolutely amazing. And right. It's...
Well, go ahead. Take your doctor's call. I'll do the snook thing. You go get your doctor's call. All right. That could be important. It's your health, Robert. Yeah. You can't do this if you're dead.
I got an hour to live.
All right. RJ, you ever been snook fishing on the beach?
Oh, I have. That's one of my favorite things to do.
I actually love it. Be able to wade out there about knee deep and just cast right along the shore. I would say the biggest mistake people make, because this is prime spawning time. May and June are the months where all the snook want to get together and make babies. They're laying eggs. They're fertilizing eggs. And what's your favorite technique? Got a favorite lure technique?
I like a mirror lure, something small at this time of year. I don't like the bigger lures at this time of year.
And so you want an MR-14 or an MR-17, one of those newer little white bait looking ones.
Yes, yeah, exactly right. The white bait looking ones or the mossback looking ones.
Well, the mossback comes into color. Now, the mossback is kind of an 18, and then there's one, a 20. It might be a 20. It's not a 26. It might be a 28. When you look at the back of a mirror lure, you're going to see MR-18, MR-52, that's mirror lure, and then the 52 or the 17 or the 14 determine the body style, and then the last number, like 18 is greenback, white, silver sides, white belly, 21 is the redhead, white belly, that last number's color. So it's actually an easy system if you actually know what it is, but most people never have an idea what it is.
You know, I buy my lures by how they look.
Yeah.
So the more you do to attract my eye, the more likely you are I'm going to buy the lure. But anyway, you get onto the beach, and an old fella taught me this technique. I used to cast straight out, 90 degrees to the shoreline, because you figure, well, the fish are the furthest away from you. That turns out not to be true whatsoever. You do two things. You walk along and you shuffle your feet. You're about knee deep now, and you shuffle your feet as you go. And one good reason for doing that is stingrays. Nothing screws up a beach walk more than stepping on a stingray, let me tell you. So you shuffle your feet, and you make a couple of casts ahead of yourself and try to be as parallel to the shore as you can. You know,
you want to keep your lure in about 2 to 3 feet of water.
Yes, yes. And then after you've made a couple of casts in front of you, turn around and cast back into that sand cloud that you've made behind you, and bring it in that way. And I've gotten most of my hits on the return cast, the back cast.
That's an exceptional point, because as you shuffle your feet going along, you're disrupting the sand, making little critters pop up. You're actually in kind of a offhanded way chumming.
You're chumming, exactly right.
And you're disturbing the bottom. I always tell people, when I'm sitting there fishing against the shoreline, and especially like, say, at Cape Hayes, I anchor as far away from the shore as I can, and just so I can barely get the bait up next to the shoreline. And then when the boats come by, I try and wave them between me and the shore. I want them to go right in front of me between my boat and where I'm fishing for the fish. Because this is an area where the boats always run through there. The fish are used to it. If they weren't used to it, they didn't like it, they wouldn't be there. So as the boat goes through, the fish know that prop wash is going to blow up the shrimp, the pinfish. They're going up into the water column, getting all discombobulated, and they all run out to eat. And when I was first fishing there, I got mad at a guy for coming between me where he should have been able to run. I was being the jerk, anchored up, making it hard for him to get around through an area. It's the only place you can get through. So I just, because I was embarrassed because I was a jerk, I let a boat go through, and I cast right behind it, and boom, I hooked up. Boom. I mean, every time a boat goes through, I'd be sitting there with a charter begging people to run through because I wouldn't be catching a lot of fish. And I'd tell people, reel in, okay, cast close as you can to the motor without hitting the boat. And all right, cast, and doubles, triples, quadruples, almost all the time. It's awesome. And you're kind of doing the same thing with your feet.
And I find when I do that, you seldom see this type of hookup as you're casting ahead of yourself. When you cast behind yourself, you start to pick up reds also, because the reds come to that cloud, because you're kicking up sand fleas and little coquinas and things like that. So the more you shuffle your feet, the better. You know, it's not like you're trying to keep the dust down so that it's going to drive them away. It actually attracts them from deeper water to come into that. So.
And the cool part about it is when you're shuffling your feet, you eliminate that boom, boom, boom. If I hit the table here, you can kind of in the background hear the mic noise. Mm-hmm. Fish are so sensitive to vibration. If you pick your foot up and you set it down, just your heel hitting the bottom, the weight of you hitting the bottom, sends out a vibration. And I mean, let's face it, if there was a giant 60 feet tall walking through downtown Northport here, we would feel the vibration as he walked by. That's you walking through the water in the land of fish.
Well, and I can tell you as a diver too, you can hear that when you're underwater up close to the beach, you know, snorkeling, you hear these thumping sounds, and it's usually the people in, you know, walking around in the surf and playing and things like that. So you hear all of that. Sound transmits much better in water than it does in air. So, yeah, it's surprising how much noise you can make.
But by sliding your feet, you eliminate the human thump, thump, thump. You're digging up stuff on the bottom. You're not getting stuck by stingrays. You're catching more fish. I don't see a downside to the whole thing. Just remember and slide your feet.
Slide your feet, right. So, and you might find a flounder or two back in that cloud.
Yeah, nobody says, oh, I'm worried about stepping on a flounder. You ever seen the teeth in a flounder?
Yeah.
I mean, I got to tell you, I think if you put your foot in the bottom half of a flounder's back, I think he's going to do everything in his power to bite you. And they got some big teeth.
I mean, pretty enormous teeth.
You're back. Are you going to die?
No.
Does your doctor say you're going to live?
I don't know.
What happened?
They just changed my appointment to earlier.
Oh, okay. So we got to go from here right to the doctor?
No, we're fine.
Okay. So we don't have to leave now, right?
No.
All right. Just making sure you're not going
to
die.
They'd have to reschedule that.
Okay. We've been talking about snooking the beaches. RJ's using a mirror lure he likes, like an MR-17, MR-14. I'm going to go, I like the 52 mirror lure, but I think I'm going to go with a Rapala X-Rap 08 OG. That's the mid-size lure with a lip on it. I like the one with the tail. I like that bucktail on the last treble hook. So, you know, that feathered look gives it a little more action to it. I would either do that or a jig. What would you do?
Are we talking daytime fishing?
Yeah, snook fishing, daytime, wading the beach. Casting, keeping daytime. Your lure within 2-3 feet of water.
I'm probably going to go with the 17MR mirror lure.
So you're going to go RJ Singh.
Yeah.
All right. You don't have to be original. It's okay.
And that's it works so well. It catches so much. It simulates the white bait, which is going to be one of their primary food sources this time of year.
You know what I'm going to want to try? I'm ordering them this week. We should have them right before I cast. You know that Rapala or Rapala twitching mullet, the one that looks nothing like a mullet. It's actually a greenback.
Right.
They got that in a smaller size.
Okay.
That's coming out this year.
That'll be neat.
So, because to me, that twitching mullet, which is the dumbest name on the planet for the lure, it's really a little big, and it's got a little too much flotation. It's perfect if you've got a foot 18 inches of water, but it's got a little more flotation than I like. I think the smaller one is not going to be able to float as much. I think you're going to be able to get a little better action out of it. It comes with two single hooks on it. There's no treble hooks on this lure, and I think that small one, excuse me, and I have a frog in my throat. I've got a full-blown moose hog. All right, anyway, I'm just like, what happened to my throat? Okay, so right along the beaches, if you're in a boat and you're going to go along, say, Gasparilla Island or, you know, one of them, I keep the boat backing up so I can throw the lure up onto the sand running with an electric motor on as slow as it'll go. I throw my lure onto the sand and work it back off from the sand, usually getting my hits within the first 6 feet of the sand.
Yeah.
So, which is knee-deep water on average.
Yeah, that happens a lot out there because those fish are feeding in that surface zone where it's a little bit more turbid water. Lately, with all the wind and everything else, we've had some pretty good rip currents, too, that have been right up along the surf line. So not only have you got the waves crashing, but now you've also got a sideways current pulling a lot of that bait, little crabs, little coquinas, shrimp, and bait fish are just totally getting confused.
What the rip current does is it sucks the water from each side of it along the shore and then shoots it out in a central point. And it's that sideways motion of the water coming, you know, parallel to the shore. It's pulling it right along the edge of the beach and then blowing it out. Because normally the waves push in, then pull back out, push in, pull back out. But whenever you get a little rip current, it's literally sucking the water in from the left and right of it to make it go back out.
Right.
And that drags that bait right along the shoreline, disturbs all the shore because it's an unnatural movement. It's not the normal push and pull of the waves. So it digs up new stuff, new bait, new features for the fish to feed on.
Nope, that's a good way to describe it. I like it.
Okay.
You know, I've heard it described a few different times, but that one is actually visually, mentally in your head. You can picture it. It's pretty
I'm
good.
On radio. I'm trying to draw a picture here.
I get
you know,
it.
I put it up here. I ain't Picasso. I can't, you know, do the whole thing like that. But I can darn sure draw a stick figure.
There you go.
Okay. Speaking of me and stick figures, bass fishing. What's going on fishing right now?
That's been amazing right now. Even though the spillways are just kind of been consistent, there's not as much bait flowing off of them.
You guys
are catching them on shiners.
I don't know if I put that place where we went to up under the Northport button. I got to remember to look on the website, make sure I put a button under Northport, because I added that one place where we went to, something bayou or slough.
Deer Prairie Creek?
Yeah. Awesome place.
It's a beautiful little park.
Absolutely awesome. Got a little kayak ramp down below the dam. You got a place you can put boats in above the dam. You got freshwater on one side, brackish water on the other side. There should be snook and tarpon below the dam. Although it's probably getting a little late in the water run for that, but we got to go up, take the boat, see how far up we can get, and then go down towards the... We'll get a couple of vehicles and drop in up there and then go down with the current.
Okay. That'd be kind of neat.
But yeah,
the bass fishing in general on any lake, pond, canal is doing incredible. I mean, the shiners have been by far the best bait to use, but the plastic lizards, plastic worms have been working real well. And still, again, you know, lots of frogs. And I think over the next couple of weeks, we're still going to see frogs being one of the more productive ones. But...
Well, at night at my house, it's almost deafening.
I think in another...
Right. And it's frogs and, I mean, every kind of frog, freaking frog you can imagine. It would have been nice to, a couple of nights to let, kind of like the windows open. It's deafening, the frogs.
Yeah.
It's got to be a primary food because there's like a billion of them in my block.
Exactly. And over the next couple of weeks... Beetle spins or small inline spinners are going to be a very productive thing to use because the tadpoles are going to hatch out. So the bass will feed on those. The bluegill will feed on those. That'll become another primary food source for them.
Oh, yeah, and that's going to happen any day now.
Yeah.
Because it's been raining for, what, 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's anywhere from 5 to 15 days, depending on the species of frog, for it to go from eggs to tadpole.
So at any moment now, you're going to have a major tadpole, you know, push into all the waters, and that's all about inline spinners like the rooster tail or those types, the MEPS types.
Yep.
And I got to tell you, that's all good. And beetle spins are forever.
Absolutely.
You just can't beat that. RJ, you're kind of like me. Life gets in the way of your fishing. When's the last time you got bass fishing?
Well, it's been last year at this time.
Really? That soon?
Yeah.
I would have put money on like 10 years.
And that was just like pulling up to some place, pulling the rod out of the back, take a couple of casts, and then go back to work. So does that count?
Yeah, it counts. Hey,
I drowned a lure, so, you know.
Nobody said, when's the last time you went bass catching?
Right.
It was, when's the last time you went bass fishing? And that's kind of my thing. I've been... peacock bass fishing, largemouth over in the Stick Marsh, But I haven't done much around here in the ponds and stuff. I bet you it's been about 2 years, 3 years. And I'm dying to get back out and do it again. I love going to Cecil Webb. And I like putting a little boat in with the trolling motor and then throwing topwaters all around the lily pads there. That it's a great place for Zip and Ziggy with the green back, little silver on the sides. Man, that's just awesome watching bass blow up on it.
Anytime they hit topwater is absolutely amazing.
But I will tell you, my new all-time favorite freshwater lure is the Rapala Ripstop.
Yeah.
That Ripstop, we had one place, and there was definitely fish there, schoolie bass. I didn't make more than three casts without a bass on. Cast, fish. Cast, fish. Cast, fish. Cast, fish. I mean, that Ripstop, as long as you start it and stop it a little bit, bam, 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 whether it's peacock bass, largemouth bass, they love that thing. That is, I've got more fish, you know, a higher ratio of hookups on that lure than any other freshwater lure I ever threw.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I would have just never believed a new lure could do what some of my old favorites did.
Right.
Never would have dreamed. I'll get you one of those, RJ. You got to take it out. I mean, if there's a bass anywhere, he's going to eat it. It's literally staggering.
My favorite has always been the jitterbug in the frog format. And for me, the trick was not to let it go for more than a couple of inches and stop it. And let it go a couple more inches and stop it. And that seemed to be effective. And I always get hit as soon as I stop it. So
that's usually...
We used to bet on each bass. We had like a drinking game with me and my one brother-in-law. And, you know, I could tell you, you get pretty tore up because every time the other guy gets a fish, you got to take a shot. And I could tell you, it was hard getting back to the house many nights.
I can imagine, yeah.
Then it was all done with jitterbugs. Middle of the night, go out there, throw jitterbugs, and just catch bass.
Well, you know, it's the old favorite, the old classic to catch bass on top water. It's always been the jitterbug.
Yeah, I would say it's my most fun. Listen to that blip, 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 with that jitterbug coming across the surface.
Yeah.
All right.
And it's easy to work. That's what makes it even better.
I just wanted to get on. The sharks are where, Robert?
All below Cape Hayes, you know, from Marker 6, Marker 5 area out towards Boca Grande and all through the intercoastal. There really isn't any big ones around to speak of that I've heard about, but there's a lot of those 2 to 4 footer in the black nose, Atlantic sharp nose. I've heard of a couple small bulls and black tips, mostly down in the intercoastal, down towards Captiva and Redfish Pass.
All right, I'm about ready to gag here.
Oh, wow. There's a good segue.
Yeah.
I like it.
How do you feel like gagging?
Sure.
Okay. It opens this weekend.
That one alone altogether.
I love gag.
Okay.
All right. Gag Grouper's opening up.
Yes, it is.
So what is so all-fired special that makes it a big deal that gag's opening up? What do you think, Robert?
I don't know.
You ready to talk about it?
They don't intrigue me.
Are you
that
ready?
Much. I'm ready to talk about them, but they don't tickle me that much. The only thing I don't like I like about them is that you can catch them on so many different techniques and so many different geographic locations compared to all your other grouper that are out there.
It's another one of those that grows up in the harbor, in the back bays, and then goes out deep water.
Right.
Except I don't think they all do that. I think some of them actually spawn and
like
grow
snook.
Up. But I think a percentage of them come back into the mangrove shorelines and stuff, and then as they get bigger, move out. Now, Pine Island Sound and that area in between Southern Pine Island and Sanibel loads up with gag grouper.
Yes,
those flats are just full of small, tiny gag grouper.
Yeah.
I love catching them on. I use a DOA cal shad. I like the redhead with the salt and pepper, clear salt and pepper body with the white belly and the bright chartreuse tail.
Okay.
And that little shad with the paddle tail on it, toss it out quarter ounce. I let it hit the water, and I just reel it back in nice and easy. I don't do a lot of jigging with it or jerking. Just give a nice, steady retrieve to it. And gag grouper after gag grouper, ladyfish, mackerel, whatever. It's just very productive. But those little gags love it.
Yeah.
If you can keep the puffers off of it.
Well, yeah, and you're going to catch a lot of other fish for incidental bycatch, but at least it gives you an idea on that, you know, Charlotte Harbor is a nursery for gag grouper.
And I've caught them like 4 to 6 inches long all the way on up to actually almost legal size, 18 inches on the flats. But then in order to really start getting an actual legal size every once in a while, you've got to get a little deeper water.
Yeah.
Now, every once in a blue moon, they come up to the Alligator Creek Reef or maybe even the deep holes?
Yeah, yeah. Alligator Creek Reef will always hold a few on it. But we also have that weird point during the, you know, usually just before the rainy season start, which is, you know, early this year. But for some reason, they'll push out. I don't know if they're pushing out of areas along the intercoastal or out of the passes, but they'll actually move from that stretch between what is really the hill at Boca Grand Pass, you know, 18-foot mark.
Right.
And they'll push up on the backside of the ICW where guys are chasing the tarpon, and they'll follow that scum line. And there will be guys that will go out there, and you'll hear about it for 4 or 5 days straight where guys are catching gag grouper either mixed in with the tarpon or off while they're shark fishing in that same general vicinity. And then you won't hear about it again for another year. And they're out in, like, open open water.
All right. Here's when you get a tideling like that. And when you see the scum on the water where it's built up and you've got a very distinct line of weird foam and leaves and all this other garbage, that is the intersection between the incoming and outgoing tides. Now, as that water, one is trying to go out, the other's trying to come in, or, you know, vice versa. But usually when the tide's going out and you get an incoming tide started, right at that point, the water can roll. It's like if you took two wrapping paper tubes, big cardboard tubes,
yeah,
and you laid them side by side, and one's rolling forward, the other's rolling backwards. And I've seen video of it on the Pacific. I got to see it in person just a tiny bit, where there's literally like a canyon forms, where the water's rolling and pointing down.
I've seen that, and it's pretty, it's very, very freaky.
It's really freaky, because you got water spinning on both sides, and so the water boils up and then shoots down right in between those two. There, it's a very, I forget the exact name of it, tubular or something or whatever, but the water literally boils, rolls each way like counterworking Mixmasters. And that would shoot water very strongly at the bottom, blowing up all kinds of bait, getting everything going. And you get a lot of smaller bait trapped right in that area because they're getting caught in all that swirling and everything else. And it does happen in Charlotte Harbor. And I think that might be what the gag are following. They're coming up to where all this stuff kind of gets trapped between that water rolling each way. And it's kind of like two waterfalls coming together right at one point.
Yeah, yeah. It's, if you ever get a chance to witness it, because it's a very common thing.
Do you understand what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it.
Okay, so I don't, I have no idea how to explain this phenomenon, but it's literally where the incoming and outgoing tide meet, and the water on both sides begins to roll, pushing against each other, and then it literally forms a jet going to the bottom, and it traps bait. It blows up stuff off the bottom. I think that's why the gag are there.
Yeah, that would make sense. I mean, it's the only real rational reason for them to be there, because there's not...
And as a disclaimer, boys and girls, that is particularly a Frankism. It does not reflect the opinion of anybody but Frank, and may or may not be true, and, you know, we have no idea. But it's what we said.
Right.
Okay.
That's pretty cool, though.
Gag grouper along that harbor. Now, Boca Grand Pass, Captiva Pass are probably the two most well-known passes for catching legal-sized gag grouper.
For the first several days.
For the first several days.
After that, they get harvested out of there. They don't last very long.
All right.
You know,
Is there any of the other passes where they may or may not show up?
I've heard of them occasionally in Redfish Pass and up there in Venice Inlet. But other than that, that's about the only other place I've heard them with some consistency over the years, but it's always been primarily Boca Grande and Captiva. And I think it's because they're deeper, rockier bottom, palm trees, whatever. There's so much structure and habitat that it allows them plenty of refuge and ambush points.
Yeah, they like laying up and being able to go out and attack stuff. You heard of any gag grouper in any of the passes?
No, I haven't.
All right. I should have mentioned RJ. I'm sorry. I look at you and talk, and that's what is easy. You're going to like in our new studio. If you look right, there's a timer. If you look left, there's a timer, too, by the way.
Is that a hint for this studio?
Yeah. No. It's not. I got my timer right there. I actually bought one of those. It's going to be in there, too. We have new studios coming and old studios. We've got studio A, B, and C, and D at this point, I think. Anyway, gag grouper are not in the canals.
No.
If you are catching grouper in your canals and you're thinking, oh, man, I love these, go right out my backyard and I'm catching these gag grouper out of there, you are not. That's for Cape Coral. That's for Port Charlotte. There's a slight chance in Venice, but there's a half a 1% chance in PGI that it's a gag. There's probably a 5% chance in Venice canals it's a gag. And there's 0% chance in Port Charlotte or Cape Coral that it's a gag.
Right. I would agree with you.
They're Goliath grouper, Jewfish, whatever you prefer to call them. There was a whole thing. RJ, were you telling me how Jewfish got its name?
Yeah, they were called jeweled fish by the Spanish because of all the colored spots on them.
Jeweled fish.
Jeweled fish. And we just happened, you know, we Floridians shortened it to Jewfish, and then somewhere along the line the PC crowd said, oh, no, you can't call these Jewfish.
Yeah, well.
So now FWC calls them Goliath grouper. But.
And we always laughingly refer to it as, you know, Goliath won the Jews, you know. I mean, poor David, he kicked Goliath's butt one time. Goliath got him back, got the Jews kicked off the fish.
Well, you would think that the Goliath people would be upset about this, but we haven't heard from them yet.
Yeah.
So they must not be as well organized.
Well, you know, so anyway, but, you know, over the term of your life, you meet hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are Jewish religious people. I've never heard one in all the years that we called them Jewfish ever go, oh, wow, that's insulting. Not once.
My suspicion is it probably wasn't anybody from the Jewish community that complained.
I would have to think most Jewish people have a lot more going on in their lives than, gee, I think I'm going to complain about the name of a fish. All right. I would have to give them more credit than that. All right, anyway, getting back into Goliath grouper, they're in the canals. The only way you tell the difference is the shape of the tail. Everybody says, oh, I was catching these great gags in my canal. Well, if it has a rounded tail or paddle tape shale, that is a Goliath grouper or Jewfish. If it has a straight edge on the back tail from the fin to the bottom of the fin is a straight line, that would be a gag grouper. If it's rounded where the center point of the tail sticks out further than the top point or bottom point, that's definitely not allowed to keep. Paddle tail, got to go back in the water. It's like $1,500 if you get caught eating one. And I know it's your backyard legal and it's your God-given right to do whatever you want to do because it's your backyard. But I would really think you ought to think that at $1,500 fine, that's $750 of fillet. Is it really worth doing whatever you want to get a possible $750 fillet fine? Not to me, boys and girls.
Yeah, and, you know, and our biggest thing is that, yes, we give our opinions on stuff, but our biggest job is to try to educate everyone on the proper way and the laws at the same time, because they're the one that gets a ticket, not us.
Yeah, I don't get a ticket if you catch me illegal fish.
It doesn't bother me to an extent.
Doesn't bother me at all. Not even a little bit.
It bothers me when people poach stuff because usually they've got kids.
No, I mean when they get a ticket.
Oh, when they get a ticket, no, that doesn't faze me.
I actually happen to like my kids and grandkids, and I don't want people poaching fish because, you know, but now I have met some of their kids and some of their grandkids.
That's true.
I wouldn't save fish for them either.
Well, that's true.
I'm sorry. RJ's going, oh, my God, you actually said that. But, you know, I like my kids. I think they're okay. They're successful. They do well. You know, I'd like to see some fish around for them. So don't poach. Keep them for your kids and your grandkids. Because you probably have good kids.
And there's a reason that these are a protected species. It's because their population numbers are low enough that if you keep taking them out of there, the it's going to crash. The population crashes, and then you don't see the fish anymore.
The problem that we have is our area is one of the few with an overabundance of Goliath grouper, Jewfish. The vast majority of their years ago range is very little, if any, fish. We've been very lucky in Southwest Florida and the Keys to have an overabundance of them. The weirdest thing about the Goliath grouper, although we're doing a segment on gag, is that any of the reefs that have a big Goliath on them have more snapper, more grunts, more table fish than reefs that don't have the gag grouper on them.
Right.
Or the Goliath grouper on them.
Right.
Okay, but we were talking about catching them in the past. Let's slip out. How far out right now do you think you would have to go? Is it in the past, 3 miles out, 15 miles out, 30, 50? Where are you going to go to find these gag grouper when they come in this weekend?
Honestly, you're probably going to find them at all those locations because basically up until it started blowing, you know, a little over a week ago, I was starting to get some mixed reports of people catching gags from the passes, 3 miles out, 7 miles out, even as far out as, you know, 40 miles. So I think you've got just as good of a chance catching them in any part of the water out there right now.
Now, when I get out there, I don't want to have to go further than I have to find fish. So I'm going to start checking the reefs like Mary's, Power Pole, Helen's. What's funny about the Power Pole is there's a barge, there's a crane, there's all kinds of stuff in the Power Poles besides the Power Poles. I have all the exact coordinates on fishandfranks.com. Go to the reef section, you'll see that. I like fishing a lot of different bottom fishing methods. Now, when it comes to gag grouper, I prefer my anchor down. I go through, and I'm going to look for structure. All right? I'm going along, and all of a sudden, I see something rise up. I try and mark it on my GPS, but I throw a buoy over. I think if you don't have a buoy when you go out to anchor on a reef, you're never going to be able to catch fish as good as you could if you had a buoy.
Right.
Because your GPS, you're going along trying to find that GPS coordinate, and you're going real slow, and it's right in front of you, right in front of you, now it's behind you. Because the GPS kind of skips when you're going really slow. It doesn't fluidly smooth go forward like it does when you're doing 10 miles an hour or something. That's a pretty smooth up to the spot. But when you're down there and you're just bumping the boat in and out of gear looking for something, all of a sudden it's in front of you, now it's behind you. And it just jumps like that. It makes you nuts. But if you can go along at a relative, you know, 5, 10 miles an hour, nice even pace going across, see the bump come up in your GPS, throw a marker buoy out the back. I have about 2 to 5 pounds of lead on it, construction twine, and I use a laundry detergent jug. Now, I know I sell all the different fishing ones, but I like the Tide or Era orange jugs. They're real heavy. They don't collapse when you wrap the line on them. And I put some construction twine and about 2 pounds of lead on it, wrap it around there, and I can throw it off the back of the boat nice. They're cheap. I don't really, you know, if it's something happens and I can't get back to it, I'm not crying that I left a $125 buoy in the water.
Yeah.
You know, it's 10 bucks for the weight and $3 for the string. So, but I'm going to drop that buoy on there, and then I'm going to come back by that buoy, and I'm going to bring the boat up. I like drifting with a slip sinker rig. So I get up current, and I want to drift past that marker jug. If I hook a fish, I'll stop, anchor up, and fish it. If I'm drifting by that jug and I don't hook anything or nothing happens, I'll grab the jug and keep go looking for a different spot. But I don't anchor up right away. I'm not big unless I know the spot and I know it's exactly where I want to be and I think there's going to be a lot of fish there. But if I'm test holing, you know, prospecting, I drop my buoy, drift by it, see if I hit a fish. If I don't, I'll go back, collect the marker, and keep looking.
No, that's a good way to do it. The other thing is, it's great about that is people don't realize gag grouper is one of the few species of grouper that doesn't necessarily have to sit directly on the structure. There's a lot of times where they actually sit 20 to 100 feet off of the structure. Well, so by drifting past that little area, sometimes you're going to get into that strike zone of that gag grouper to just confirm that there is life down there.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking. I'm drifting before I get to it, up on it, and then off the other side of it. Mm-hmm. So I'm really kind of covering that on and off basis. Now, if I'm going to go, let's say I hooked a fish. Okay, we're going to fish this buoy. I'm going to try and look at the buoy, see which way that buoy is taking the current.
Yeah.
Look for the water, you know, pushing against it. And then you got to figure the wind blowing and that whatever that current is on that buoy and try and get a mark in the middle of that. I go away from it, drop my anchor. And when I drop my anchor to let line out so I can end up fishing on that buoy, that will usually scare the gag grouper off of the reef.
Yeah.
It's, to me, and you've told me this, and after you told me, I was looking it up more, and what happens is when there's a big noise, something scary happens, the gag grouper will be feeding up by the reef, and then they'll all run out away from the reef and then stop out there in the middle of nowhere and turn around and look back going, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah.
They don't back into a hole in the reef the way a red grouper or a Goliath grouper would. They literally go out and look and go, what's going on? So as they're out there, you know, so having your anchor swing, and that's why I like leaving the buoy in place when I'm fishing, because I can watch the boat swing, hit a gag on the outside swing, come back, hit the snappers over the when it's on the buoy, swing out to the outside, hit a gag, because a lot of times just the act of fishing, dropping the lead weights, having them hit the reef, can actually push those gag grouper to the outside. So the more your anchor swings, the more on and off of the reef that you get, the more likely you are to catch gag grouper.
No, that works very, very well. And that you'll actually see them change their coloration a lot, too, from when they're sitting on that structure to when they swim to those outside patches of sand. You know, they'll go from darker to extremely light-colored.
It's amazing how quickly they can do it, too.
Oh, yeah, it's almost like squid, you know, that just, I mean, instantly go from dark to light. It's pretty cool to see. And now, like you said, there's a lot of videos to actually see that from divers. From divers that prove how that's done in spear fishermen. It's
RJ's
cool.
Our resident diver guy.
Yeah, he's the only one crazy enough to get in the water.
No, I've done it.
Well,
I've been down
that's
there.
True. I forgot about that. I don't.
Yeah, no, I've been down there diving. We don't want to talk about that. All right, what's your favorite grouper rig, Robert? How do you, what kind of rig do you use grouper fishing?
For actual, like, live bait grouper rig?
Dead bait, live bait.
Well,
pick
bait,
one. What's your
bait.
Favorite way to fish with bait for grouper?
To be honest with you, I mean, over the last several years, I've just had such good success with the porgy rig.
Okay,
you know,
what's
or,
a porgy rig?
Or a chicken rig, whatever you want to call it. Basically, you're taking your swivel under your main line, about 3 to 4 feet of leader line. Well, you can actually do it with a three-way swivel, too. Would that be correct?
Either way is fine.
Yeah.
But so you're going from a swivel up on the top. You're using a standard AFW mighty swivel, just this steel-on-steel swivel, because you don't really need it to be a ball bearing, although
right.
A ball bearing swivel is kind of ideal at the top of a chicken rig because for all the spinning it does.
Yeah.
But you go down about, I would say, cut at least 2 feet of line, because by the time you tie your knot to the swivel and your knot to the three-way swivel, you're down to about 18 inches. You're going
right.
to use up at least 6 inches of line there. Now you tie your three-way swivel in.
Yep.
Now, off the bottom of the three-way swivel, do you cheat and run a little lighter line down to your sinker, or do you stay with the same line all the way down?
I used to cheat with the lighter line, but honestly...
Because it's illegal to do.
Well, yes.
Now, it is illegal to use the line from your swivel to your three-way swivel and the line from your three-way swivel to your sinker. By law, would have to be the same, because otherwise it would be a breakaway and you'd be intentionally throwing water in there. But if you had 6 knots on the uni wrap on the top and 6 knots on the uni wrap on the swivel, and then on your sinker you had 1 wrap on a uni knot, that's technically not illegal.
Technically not.
It could possibly come apart quicker than the other knot, but I'm not sure it'd be legal at that point. because you still have the same strength all the way up and down. The idea is you're not supposed to break away.
Right.
So I guess that would be illegal if you're if you intentionally tied a bad knot on the bottom. It, it would be kind of illegal.
It's a matter of how you want to sleep that night, you know. And I personally, you
know, much harder to prove.
Yeah, I used to not mind it so much, but in all honesty, lead has gotten so blooming expensive in the last couple of years too that I really don't like losing it if I can help it.
I'd almost rather lose the fish than the sinker at this point because of the cost of lead.
Yeah.
It used to be really cheap and kind of throwaway stuff, but now it's, you know, it's expensive.
Yeah.
So anyway, three-way swivel up, and I do about two pieces each, about 24 to 30 inches long. That way you get two nice sections. Now, how do you like your leader line, which comes off of the middle point of the three-way coming off the side? Do you like that on a short leash so it stands up more, or do you like it on a longer leash so it droops?
I usually do at least 24 inches.
And then tie the knots, or?
Yeah, I'll tie like a 24-inch leader coming off the three-way swivel out to my hook and just do that. You know, I'm just using
So is it 24 before you tied the knots or after you tied the knots?
Right after I've tied the knots.
So you're starting with a 30-inch, 32-inch piece of leader material.
Yeah.
Tying the knot to the three-way and then tying the knot to the hook. So you
correct.
End up with 20 to 24 inches.
On the bare minimum, 24 inches. I don't like going less than 24. I know you do and quite a few of other people do, but I find
if I'm making it a double drop, I want the top one to be very, very short, and the bottom one can be a lot longer.
Right.
But I don't want that top one drooping down into the bottom one.
No,
so
you don't
I
want
make
it to
that as
tangled.
Short as possible.
Right. Yeah.
That's on a double drop chicken rig.
Right.
That's when you got a flock of chickens.
That's when you're looking for, like, the little groceries, you know, your grunt snappers and stuff like that. But for grouper, honestly.
Speak for himself, Kimosabi.
I
put big hook, big bait on the bottom one, smaller hook, smaller bait on the top one.
Oh, there you go.
I want a big fish and a small fish. Nice. I want them all.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice. That's actually pretty smart.
Okay, white man. Don't tell them what we want over here.
Hey, that's all good.
Okay.
I just like a single hook personally, though.
RJ, favorite grouper rig.
Oh, I would say a slip sinker. Slip sinker on a line that gets stopped from going towards the hook with a swivel.
Limited travel slip sinker rig.
There you go.
Okay.
There you go. I knew it had a name.
So what you're doing is you're coming down with your main line. You put the line through the egg sinker, then tie the line to a swivel.
Right.
And from your swivel to your hook, 3 feet, 2 feet?
3 feet. 3 feet's
three
good,
feet.
Yeah.
All right, now, in order to make RJ's rig possible, you've got your hook and about 3 feet of line to your swivel, leader material. I usually use like 40 to 60 pound test, monofilament or fluorocarbon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've fed my line through the lead egg sinker so it can slide up and down the line, allowing me to feel the bite better. Then I put a split shot up about 18 inches from the swivel above the weight. And that split shot is not acting as a weight, but it's acting as a stopper to keep my swivel or my egg sinker from going too far up the line. Is that kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, I haven't used the split shot thing, but that sounds like a good idea because I've had some tangling problems with it running free.
Well, when you have a bait on and you're running the line through the egg sinker so it can pull all the way through, the bait acts as a parachute, and the lead's trying to fall as fast as possible. So as that lead's trying to fall very quickly, the bait's slowing it down so it can't go. So it literally starts pulling line through the egg sinker, and there can get to be 6, 8, 10, 12 feet, and then it starts wrapping around your main line.
Mm. So yeah, and I've had that problem. So you're right. That would solve that.
So the other thing you could do is just drop it very slowly. You got to really slow it down on the way down, allowing that sinker to stay in contact with the swivel. So slowing down your drop or putting the split shot above that would...
I like the split shot. I mean, the split shot, you taught me that. That was one of the first really cool tricks you taught me with grouper fishing.
Well, I've learned something on this show. Fantastic.
You know, yeah. And I've even modified that a little bit where I do like a knocker rig where my egg sinker's on my leader and falls all the way to my hook.
Right.
But then I slide the egg sinker up to my swivel, so it's below my swivel, but I'll slide it all the way up, and then I'll put a split shot about 3 to 6 inches below the sinker, so it kind of stays right in between the sinker and the swivel on my leader line. And that's for two reasons, because so a couple of my reels I'm using braided line, and a split shot doesn't want to stay still on a braided line at all, no matter, I don't care if you take a pair of channel locks to it, it's going to slide.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
But the other reason why I do it is for traveling. When it's on the boat going back and forth, I can slide that sinker all the way down to my hook and then have my hook down by my reel so it's right up against the foam of my handle so it's not vibrating on the blank and I'm not having to twist and wrap line around for storage purposes.
Now, I'm going to give you that because an egg sinker lead weight has a hole in the middle of it. When you put your line through it, it going up and down, believe it or not, braided line goes bad more than monofilament from a sinker sliding up and down.
Oh, absolutely.
People would think that the braided line would hold up better than monofilament with that sinker sliding on it, and it's just not true. The egg sinker rubs in that braided and deteriorates it very quickly, where the mono, it chases it, but it doesn't destroy it as quick. I don't know why. It should be the opposite way.
Right.
So your idea of combining the knocker rig with what RJ likes to do, and that is by tying your hook 40 to 60 pound monocarbon or monofilament or fluorocarbon leader. And I don't really know that there's a benefit. If you're fishing in 30 feet of water, I would definitely do the fluorocarbon. You're going to get more hits. But once you hit 60 feet of water, I honestly don't think there's a difference between a fluorocarbon leader and a mono leader, because the whole idea is to bend light the same way as water. And down there 60 feet, there's not a lot of light to bend.
Not as much, yeah.
Not
absolutely.
As much. So I think it kind of at 60 feet, it's going to be kind of a 6 1/2 to the other fluorocarbon mono. Once I'm in 80 or 100 feet, I don't think I'd waste the money on the fluorocarbon. I just don't think there'd be enough light to make a difference.
Yeah, as you go deeper, too, it gets bluer. The color around you gets more and more blue until it starts to turn indigo when there's no more light, and then, you know, you got blackness. But, yeah, so you get that blue color, and I think monofilament does better camouflage in the blue than the fluorocarbon does. So, it probably, like you say, it probably makes no difference at that depth.
That's a really...
No, absolutely.
Good synopsis, man.
Well, thank you.
Way to go, RJ.
Thank you.
All right. But I'm going to tie my hook on the 40 to 60 pound monofluorocarbon, whatever you feel like spending. And I'm going to cut a piece that's about 4.5 feet long. I'm going to tie my hook on one end. I'm going to tie my, before I tie my swivel on, I'm going to put an egg sinker on the leader material, sliding so it'll slide from the hook, and then I'm going to tie the swivel to the other end. And that egg sinker can slide all the way in between there. To be it as a knocker rig where it's going to knock against the hook or knock on the bottom. That's what a knocker rig's about. It's knocking right against the hook, or when you bounce it on the bottom, it's knocking right on the bottom. But a lot of people, they like the idea of it, but they don't want that swivel right next to their hook.
Right.
So move the hook, the swivel up to, I'm sorry.
The sinker.
Move the sinker from the hook up to the swivel, and about halfway in between, put a split shot. And it gives you the best of all the worlds. So
yeah.
That easy way to take care of it. Now, chicken rig, porgy rig, whatever, the benefit of that is you're tied on to the top of the rig and the sinker's at the bottom of the rig.
Right.
And what's nice about that is it you always feel the bite.
Yes. Yeah, your hook is above your sinker, so you're more in direct contact
with
the actual
hook.
Pressure.
They don't have to move the sinker around to feel the bite. That's where if you've got a slip sinker, that's the benefit of that. As you reel up, it puts that sinker up towards the end, and as the fish pulls it, you can feel him slide that line through the sinker before he has to lift that sinker to let you know he's there.
Yeah.
So, any last words there, RJ, about gag grouper fishing?
Well, it's the season starting tomorrow, right? Good luck. Good luck to you all.
Yeah, just good luck, and make sure you use circle hooks and plenty of ice and liquids and sunblock, because it's going to be pretty warm and muggy.
And even though they're only calling for scattered storms, don't let a storm get between you and shore, and don't let anything get between you and us every Thursday from 1 to 2, right here on the mighty WKDW in Northport, Florida, the king of fishing
nice.
Stuff.
Nice. stuff. I like it.
Fish and Frank, Robert and RJ. We'll catch you guys next week. Bye.
Fish, 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 fish. Boy, I'm going fishing.